what we did do, what Frederick and I did, so we wrote together a paper, which I have to be honest, Frederick wrote most of it, so if you think this is a good paper, please congratulate Frederick. If this is a bad paper, well, blame me, please.
Thanks.
Right. Well, our paper is also a plea for record-keeping as social history, as Marcus said yesterday, or I think it was Arndt who said we have to write a histoire totale, a total geschichte of records. And we have to take economic, cultural, and social social context into account when we want to explain why records were kept. And what we did is studying one particular case study of one nobleman who kept records. So why did a nobleman keep records? That's what our main question. Well, so our paper is concerned with the question how record keeping and the manipulation of existing records was functional to local individuals and noblemen and groups, noble groups, to uphold or to propagate their social status. We will focus in particular on the relevance of archives and archive building for the status concerns of the 15th century nobility of the Burgundian Habsburg Low Countries. So our case study is about this conglomerate of regions and the low countries. We will approach this issue with discussion of a rather exceptional source, namely a manuscript of approximately 240 folios, containing a wide range of texts, all concerned with the lives and times of one John, Lord of Dadizele. That's the nobleman under discussion today. He was born in 1432 and deceased in 1481. As the lord of a single village, seigneury, near the southern border of the county of Flanders, John of Dadizele belonged to the lesser nobility. Dadizele is near Ypres. You can see Ypres here. Between Ypres and Lille, to the south, there is Dadizele situated. Yet, John of Dadizele belonged to the lesser nobility, yet this lord gradually became an important figure during the wars of the Count of Flanders, Maximilian of Austria, or against the King of France. Thanks to the influence of a patron, he was appointed to the office of bailiff of Ghent, the main largest city in the county of Flanders, in 1477. And he subsequently distinguished himself in the defense of the Low Countries against France, leading a mixture of urban militias and levies from his own seigneurial village and those of fellow noblemen. He helped to stall the French offensive against the Low Countries by the summer of 1479. As a reward, John of Dadizele received important positions in the entourage of Maximilian of Austria, but his meteoric rise to power was cut short by his murder in the autumn of 1481. We will not discuss the murder, we already published about that, but we will discuss the manuscript today. This one, here you see the tombstone of Dadizele in his village and the manuscript which he left. This manuscript presents us with a biography of John of Dadizele, a genealogy of his family, as well as with a wide range of copies of documents all pertaining to his activities as a noble lord and landowner, as a military leader, and as a princely officer and courtier. So the personal archives of this man are lost, but we still dispose of a selection of documents which he made them himself. So this is a very interesting source to study the IDs behind a record key. As it includes many unusual documents that are long lost, this work on John of Dadizele is a key source on the ruling classes of the 15th century Low Countries. Yet, while historians have delved the text for factual information, they were reticent to study the text as a whole, as it was only known through an edition published in 1850. The recent discovery of a manuscript that is clearly the original text of this edition shows that those reservations were well-founded, since the editor had rearranged the sequence of the separate texts. In the edition, the biography was presented as the opening text, whereas in the manuscript, it is tucked away between a wide array of texts, ranging from genealogical notes over excerpts from feudal registers and letters of commission. The memoirs of John of Dadizele constitute the 11th of 42 different chapters. You see it on the handout. Chapter 11 are the memoirs, the biography of this man. So they are not at the beginning of the manuscript. So the editor of this manuscript made it the crux of the manuscript, the biography, but that was not necessarily the case to the author himself. The author must have been John of Dadizel himself, since the manuscript includes many documents that were only available from the personal archives of the Lord, such as secret correspondence addressed to him, a list of the villages of Dadizel that followed their Lord to war, meticulous lists of his various properties, and so on, as you can see. Also, the production of the manuscript started in May 1480. But the last dated text included in the manuscript dates from pre-September 1481. At that point, the manuscript was clearly not completed. But this abrupt end tallies well with the fatal murder on John's life in October 1481. The literary project of the Lord of Dadizel, cut short by his assassination, is relevant to the central themes of this conference for various reasons. First, there's a peculiar setup of this manuscript, which you see here. The manuscript is unusual in that it's preponderantly composed as an assemblage, a collection of copies of text that originally served administrative purposes. Only a limited part of the manuscript consists of newly altered texts, and only one of those, the biography, is a continuous literary narrative rather than a survey of social ties, rights, and properties. Secondly, the production of this aggregate of texts was clearly meticulously executed, premeditated affair. In many cases, the family chronicle came into being organically as a corollary of practical forms of literacy, such as the keeping of accounts. This is best documented for the Italian Ricordanze and the French Livre de Raison, where the practical information of an account books soon became interspersed with household tips, genealogical and biographical notes, all kind of notes, to a point in which those additions came to constitute the bulk of the memorandum. This was certainly not the case with the Dadizel manuscript, as it does not include many practical records of which we know they must have existed, such as accounts, which revenues and expenses of the noble household, and so on. In fact, only a few texts in the manuscript might serve a practical purpose, and there is no indication that it was ever used to that effect. What also argues for careful planning of the manuscript is that while every page of the entire book was numbered beforehand by the author, many pages were carefully left blank, where information had to be added afterwards. Last but not least, the text of the 40-odd chapters are connected through a web of cross-references to other documents in the manuscript. So in sum, however disparate in composition, the various texts were consciously selected and brought together in this manuscript under a single title and table of contents to form a coherent whole, with the Lord of Dadizel as its linchpin. So the selection Dadizel made of all these documents says us something about how nobles used their archives. So brought together in this manuscript, the documents make clear that the 15th century nobleman had no difficulty in thinking of extant records in complex ways, not only seeing the practical purpose they had served, but also, in particular, how they could be redeployed to form a coherent representation of his public persona, a monument, as Paul Zumthor has put it. Historicist distinction between narrative and administrative text, as we also saw yesterday, precludes any understanding of this nobleman's project, as the Lord of Dadizel put administrative archives to work or to serve as a narrative purpose. So this man made a selection of documents to present a kind of self-image, and he was quite successful because 500 years later we're still discussing his image. But why and for whom did he keep this record, or why did he make this manuscript? So what is the kind of image the Lord of Dadizel hoped to convey to others, and who those others were supposed to be? It's an important question. So the timing of his project suggests, when he was the height of his power, that this was quite important to its author. He started at a time in which he was still occupied with the war with France as the leader of the Flemish armies, and he continued up to the summer before his death. when he became increasingly embroiled in the political conflicts between the large Flemish cities, such as Bruges and Ghent on the one hand, and Maximilian of Habsburg at the other. And this led to his assassination because he allied with the city of Ghent in its revolt against Maximilian. As to the targeted audience, the text was aimed at a highly literate public that was well-versed in the individual practice of silent reading, since most of the texts are administrative in nature and is not very suitable to be read out aloud to the entertainment of others. Next to this, the narrative segments of the manuscript, the title, the genealogies, and the memoirs, are written in Middle Dutch, a language that was foreign to many, if not most, at the French-speaking court of the Dukes. This suggests that the manuscript was intended to circulate in the closely knit world of his family and the elite families of his home region, with whom he was connected through marriage and friendship. As has been noted for the English gentry by Daniel Wolff, Flemish rural and urban elites cultivated a lively circulation of chivalric romances, chronicles, genealogies, and so on, and it can be argued that the manuscript fits in. Let's have a look at the handout here. That the manuscript was functional to the status community of the rural nobility is not only clear from the overall subject matter, lordship, properties, family, relations, and so on, but also from the careful selection of the documents. John of Dadizil was certainly not intent on making a mere coterie of all his official records, bearing on only intensely pragmatic records such as household. We know of important charters, which he certainly possessed, and of letters which he received, which he excluded from the manuscript. If they put them in a bad light, so this man was clearly very selective. The socially selective nature of the manuscript makes clear that this was supposed to convey a positive image of John to the reader. More specifically, the project was clearly concerned with establishing the public authority of the author. If you focus on what Gabriel Spiegel has called the social logic of the text, it becomes clear that John is first and foremost presented as a lord. As you see, the first chapter of his manuscript lists the village seigneury of Dadizele as one of the 12 important seigneuries of the shire, to be followed with detailed descriptions of it. After this, John's family is presented in chapters 4 and 5. Not primarily as an extended family, but as a lineage that ruled the seigneurial village from time immemorial to the present, as embodied by John of Dadizele himself. He was the end point, the end, the final end of history. That is how he constructs himself in his memoirs. And also the priests, the village officials, and seigneurial levies that effectuated his rule are listed. Only then the reader is presented with his memoirs, which are largely dedicated to his exploits in the ongoing war with France. So that's chapter 11. The memoirs carefully built on the previous texts on his status as a lord, as it's regularly stressed that John not only led urban militias and princely troops, but also bands of seigneurial levies from his own seigneury and those of neighboring nobles. Following the memoirs, the chapters 13 to 30, so most of it, the majority of the couple of charters, well, the first of which are dedicated to his seigneurial rights, and the following to all the commissions and offices received from the prince. The last 10 chapters all pertain to the dozens of other properties of John of Dadizele next to his seigneury, which provided income but not power. So, what can we conclude?
Sorry for the not so elegant shift in speakers, but. So, time to sum up, what can we conclude? I think the overall setup of the manuscript tallies very well with the conservative way in which nobility was conceived in France at this time. Unlike England, France, or Italy, the state did not yet interfere in the definition of nobility in this region, and the ownership of seigneury was still the only base for nobility. So, little wonder then that John presented himself in the manuscript primarily not as an individual, but as a lord in a long-established hereditary line of lords. That is, as a legitimate holder of a source of legitimate power. For John of Dadizele, too, the fount of noble honor was not yet the state, but the private right to village lordship. The hierarchy of the information manuscript is thus, in fact, concomitant with those places of nobility at that time. So, but now that the intended message of the manuscript as a whole is clear, we must turn to the most important question of all, namely what the records included in the manuscript were supposed to do. The Lord of Dadizele has painstakingly complemented a self-altered text, his memoirs, with a score of archived copies, and he explicated the connections through the inclusion of cross-reference. For the interpretation of this issue, we tend to disagree with current scholarship on late medieval historiography, in which this practice is usually understood as a form of evidentiary learning. Documents that were inserted in noble chronicles are usually understood as pièces justificatives, archival records that are quoted to provide proof to claims offered in the text. This interpretation has, of course, a long history stretched back to the 19th century. It is precisely this assumption about the evidentiary function of the included records that pushed the 19th century editor of the Dadasheva manuscript to reorder the sequence of the text, putting the memoirs first and reducing all other texts, all other archives included, to the status of the source appendix. The cross-reference included by the Lord of Dadasheva then supposedly function as the equivalent of our modern footnote, an instrument to substantiate claims about the past through reference to a relevant archival source. This claim that authors such as Joel, Lord of Dadasheva, were essentially engaging in a form of evidentiary learning, evidentiary historiography, deserves, we think, some caution. In 15th century Europe, historiography was primarily considered to be a literary genre that was shaped by rhetorical considerations rather than concerns of critical empiricism. Tony Grafton has shown that while some humanists contemporary to Joel of Dadasheva start to experiment with archival research and footnotes, it was only after the struggles of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation and the Pyrrhonist struggles of the late 17th century that the critical apparatus and the inclusion of documentary annexes as proof became firmly established in historiographical practice. The Lord of Dadasheva was certainly no humanist. Instead, he brought to a social milieu the nobility with a particular attitude to truth and truth-telling that was in fact largely inimical to an evidentiary approach to the past. As Yuval Harari has finally pointed out in his careful analysis of 15th and 16th century memoirs, nobles only rarely made any effort to provide proof for their claims about the past. Living in a society of orders, they consider noble honor to be the basis of the credibility, not any procedure of empirical observation. If John of Dadasheva had started the manuscript with text that showed him to be a true noble lord, he thus had shown to the reader in his own mind that his word was a word of honor and therefore trustworthy. The manuscript itself confirmed that he expected a certain suspension of disbelief from a startled audience, that is, his family and friends. The crucial passage in this respect is the opening chapter, in which he lists the 12 noble lords of his home shire, among which, of course, himself. I mean, he presents himself as John, Lord of Dadasheva, knight. He has a name, a full coat of arms, and a seigniory. The specialist of English history, and there are many of them convened together today, I think, this claim might require some explanation. Unlike England, where the conquest had led to the replacement of the Anglo-Saxon ruling class by modern French elite, continental nobles could theoretically trace back their lordship over a given locality to the very mists of time. And this is precisely what the author is doing here, with his assertion that he had the name of the seigniory, as if this implied that he belonged to the original family that owned the village lordship since it came into existence. His patrilineal descent was supposedly unbroken, and he consequently had the full and exclusive right to the coat of arms to the Lord of Dadasheva. Yet only a few folios later, the author presents the reader with evidence that this claim was patently incorrect. In the fourth chapter, he presents the reader with a list of the Lords of Dadasheva, as far as knew it, which makes clear that the original noble family had in fact died out long before his birth in the early 14th century. You see here, it starts with Sir Lambert, the Lord of Dadasheva, moves on to William, and then he names certain Lady Alix, heiress to Dadasheva, who supposedly died in 1332. And then the lineage restarts, and this must have been certainly a different family, with one Joel, Lord of Dadasheva, who stepped in as Lord of the seigniory in the early 14th century. The author of our manuscript, who was Lord of Dadasheva in the late 15th century, was in fact a descendant of the man who stepped in as Lord of Dadasheva after the death of the noble heiress, Lady Alix, in the 1330s. So he was certainly not a member of the junior branch of the original noble family of Dadasheva, but someone from a very different family, the Valdirkian family, which had purchased the seigniory in the early 14th century, and which had certainly not belonged to nobility up to that point. The newly ennobled family Valdirkian did never fully erase the history of their social promotion by discarding its own name Valdirkian, not even by the days when John himself was writing his manuscript. This made clear from preserved epitaphs of two of aunts of the author, who died some years after the more famous nephew. So here we see two other members of this family of the author presenting themselves to posterity, and remarkably to present themselves not as members of the original Dadisela lineage, but as daughters of one John of Wetigen, lord of Dadisela. In his manuscript, however, the author himself never admitted that he descended from 14th century upstarts rather than from the original high medieval noble family, instead always carefully profiling himself as John, lord of Dadisela, or simply John of Dadisela. Yet, at the same time, this carefully crafted literary construction includes transcripts that enables readers to see through the facade. This makes clear that it was essentially preaching to the choir, expecting his audience of family, friends, and liars to join him in what was perhaps not a blatant lie, but certainly the most favorable interpretation possible of the history of his house. The discussed case study allows to draw some conclusions about archives and institutes to the pre-modern nobility, we think. The Dadisela manuscript shows that it was a social group that was capable of producing a textual format that was mimetic to our modern historiography, in that it combined narrative texts with transcripts of archives. Archival records. Yet, however strong formal similarities, we would do well to keep in mind that the inclusion of archival records in noble memoirs served very different purposes than that of modern historiography, and realized that purpose in a very different way than that of our modern footnotes or source appendix. The priorities articulated through the use of archival records were very different from our own. Copies of charters, letters, and other administrative texts were not included to sustain evidential claims, but rather to elucidate, to illustrate those claims. The audience whose assumptions about veracity were not primarily based on Dennett's empiricism, but rather on shared beliefs of specific status community. All this testifies to a remarkably creative and flexible attitude towards written records and archives. Many, if not most, of the charges, sentences, letters of commissions, and feudal documents included in the manuscript had come into being to serve as a written evidence in specific administrative procedures, ranging from legal disputes to the appointment of a princely officer. Yet, the texts of those archives were all reused in the literary edifice, no longer as evidence, but as illustrations to the honor of the original beneficial. The story of this particular transformation of information of archives into literary text does more than just warn us about the dangers of historicist distinctions between administrative and narrative texts, or between narrative and footnote. Above all, it suggests we think that the history of record keeping and the use of records in pre-modern Europe is essentially social history. Thank you for your kind attention.
Straight over now to Andy Wood, who is going to talk on the contestation of the urban.
Right, thanks, Liz. The paper that I've got here today stems partly out of the book which Alex mentioned earlier, which I published with Cambridge last year, a study of social memory and customary law in early modern England. But it also stems from a current project which I'm working on with colleagues in Durham of historians, but also archaeologists and anthropologists, looking at what we're calling urban topographies, by which we mean not merely material environment of urban centres, but also imagined topographies, ways of understanding and seeing the city. And what we're trying to argue, amongst other things, as regards texts, is that the increasing desire on the part of urban authorities in particular to collect and organise, to preserve urban archives concerning customs and rights and entitlements and obligations on the parts of urban communities represents not just a kind of an administrative capture of empirical information about the city, but but also represents a kind of mental topography of the city, represents a way of reading the city. So we're assuming then that textual, visual, and cartographic images of the city are linked, but they're built around the material environment, but not determined by it. I want, therefore, to start with some coincidences followed by some propositions. From the mid-16th century within England, we see a coincidence between the expansion of literacy, the increased production of official written documentation, apparent through central state, central law courts, county and local courts, boroughs, manors and parishes. Importantly, the development of a tradition of manuscript urban chronicle writing, as one town and one city after another produces semi-official narratives of the histories of those individual cities and towns. Running alongside the development from the late 15th, early 16th century onwards of a tradition of national chronicle history publishing, most importantly Holinshed's History of the British Isles, published in 1577. And updated in 1586, to which those urban chronicles of individual towns and cities are intimately linked. Coupled with those historiographical ventures, we also see the phenomenon of cartography, which is obviously not new to the late 16th century, but it's in the latter third of the 16th century that cartography really takes off. Coupled with surveying the land, and with social surveys. The slide I've just put up is the title page from what was, you can see, a book called The Surveyor's Dialogue, published in 1607 by a surveyor called John Norden. Norden was a leading Calvinist, but also a leading proponent of the process of estate surveying. Increasingly, as lords find their rents being cut into as a result of inflation, lords turn to their estates to look at ways in which they can essentially asset strip them, ways in which they can enclose common land or cut down forests or raise rents, impose manorial monopolies on things like milling rights. And in order to legitimate these attempts to squeeze money out of their estates, lords employ surveyors such as John Norden to go out and to make a survey of the assets that obtain within a particular jurisdiction and the boundaries of the jurisdiction. So at the same time at which surveyors are listing the resources that might potentially be stripped out of an estate, they're also mapping the physical boundaries of the estate. It's a very controversial practice, and for that reason, Norden published this text in 1607 justifying the practice of surveying. And many of these surveys subsequently find their way into gentry archives, and are preserved by gentry in order to legitimate subsequent claims to, for example, the capacity on the part of lords to shift rents up in relationship to inflation rather than leaving them fixed. So the process of surveying then is a very political process. It's one which is about access to resources, but which is also about control of local customary law, and relates clearly to the issue that we're concerned with today, the organisation of archives. And what the survey does is it situates manorial documentation, medieval manorial rolls, etc., within a spatial context. It registers those entitlements upon the land, and for that reason these surveys survive in abundance within gentry archives. And there is an equivalent within the urban context in that the 16th century sees the grant of an increasing number of charters to urban centres, either extending existent liberties or establishing them for the first time. And both these urban charters again map out the boundaries of towns and cities in a manner not unlike that of John Norden and his estate surveys. So, the anthropologist James E. Scott, in his book Seeing Like a State, takes Norden's text as a kind of key moment in the development of what he calls the cadastral view, the view of the land from a top-down, the administrative gaze, as he sees it, the commodifying gaze. message was the Lord sitting in his chair, studying a map of his estates, rightly drawn by true information, which describeth so the lively image of a manor, and every branch and member of the same, such that the Lord may see what he hath, and where and how he lieth, and in whole use and occupation of every particular is upon sudden view. So this then is the commodifying gaze of seigneurial capitalism. And it was important there to notice the linkage between cartography, the production of maps, and the production of surveys. Surveys mapping out the boundaries of the estate through text, cartography mapping out the boundaries of an estate in a visual form. So there's a linkage then between cartography, surveying, and the production of the archive. If we're to understand the archive in the early modern period, we need, therefore, to spend at least some of our time thinking about cartography, because the two are intimately linked. If we're to find estate maps in the period, we must find them in estate archives reserved by lords generation after generation, because they legitimate claims on the part of manorial authorities to entitlements in the present. In the urban context, these are also linked into social surveys. The best known example of this in England is the survey of the poor conducted in Norwich in 1571, which I'll talk about in a minute. Surveys which, in particular, list poorer inhabitants and attempt to locate them within parishes within an urban site. Surveys, then, social surveys, equally represent a kind of social mapping of the city, which once again find their way into the archive, in this case the urban archive, because they are of subsequent importance to the ways in which rulers read the urban landscape, read social topographies within the city. Now, what I want to suggest is that this coincidence of these different factors is far from accidental, and that rather it was underpinned by the projection of the material interests of certain ruling groups in the countryside, manorial authorities, and in the city of civic elites. And all of this is tied into the process identified by the historians Mike Braddock and Steve Hindle of state formation, which they see as acquiring a particular intensity after the middle years of the 16th century. All of these represent, if you like, the kind of textual product of an urge towards the formation of an organic, inclusive polity, a state formation process built from a bottom up. These represent then the textual, the urban archive represents the textual expression and in an organised form of the expansion of state authority on the local level. It's also related to economic change, most notably to rural capitalism, in cities to mercantile capitalism, and as we've seen in the case of Norden surveys to fiscal seigneurialism. This is John Norden's survey of Falmer in Sussex, nowadays the site of the University of Sussex, which he conducted in 1618. It was part of the Prince of Wales estate. And this is a beautiful book of surveys. He used a survey about 25 manors, which he conducted in the late 1610s for the Prince of Wales, future Charles I. And amongst a series of rights which Sir Norden was able to pin down onto the land included the discovery that there still existed a whole bunch of people within the manor who had not yet been manumitted from the institution of serfdom, and that it was therefore possible to re-establish serfdom and so to claim money for the manumission of those serfs as late as 1618 within Falmer in Sussex. So that's an example of the kind of rights and entitlements that Norden, in the course of conducting these surveys and searches into local archives, into central archives, was able to produce. So that leads me on to a set of propositions. If we've had some coincidences, I want to suggest some propositions. Firstly, but archives, and the cartography in particular, are about the projection of power. Now, a number of papers we've heard already have suggested that archives are about power, that archives are political. They can be political in the formal sense of politics as the affairs of elites, but they're kind of political, I suppose. They're about power in a kind of fuzzier, more Foucauldian sense, in that archives represent the concentration of knowledge on the part of particular elite groups, in this case within towns and cities in early modern England, and which help to legitimate their authority on the cultural as well as the institutional level. So if archives are about power, so then are maps, and equally so is the context of the production of both maps and textual archives. Secondly, I want to suggest that there's a link between cartography and the archive. Maps are often drawn up at the same time at which land is surveyed. Historians of cartography have argued that maps aren't neutral. Anthropologists and archaeologists have made the same point about senses of a landscape. But all of those attempts to map the land, either textually through written surveys of the inhabitation, tenure upon the land, or visually through cartography, all of those attempts to map the land find their way into urban archives and into estate archives. Archives then can represent a kind of textual mapping, especially of boundaries, of physical boundaries, for instance, of jurisdictions, of cities, manors, parishes, but also of social boundaries, as in social surveys. So if archives represent a kind of textual mapping, they present us with often highly detailed accounts of the bounds of manors, of parishes, and of boroughs. Very, very specific accounts of the twists and turns of boundaries within which certain entitlements and certain obligations operate. It's inherent to customary law in the period, and this applies both to manorial law in the countryside and to borough law in towns and cities. It's inherent to customary law, but it operates only within a limited jurisdiction. You can't, in other words, have a national custom. The only national custom that exists in England is common law. Parochial, manorial, and borough custom has to operate within a fixed jurisdiction in order to have legal meaning. And for that reason, urban governors are highly anxious to make sure that the precise boundaries of towns and cities are very, very carefully delineated, and that accounts of those boundaries are protected and preserved down the generations, because it's within those boundaries that their power, their institutional authority rests. For that reason, anyone working within urban archives sooner or later will come across charters and perambulations and accounts of bounds in which you get very, very detailed information about the urban landscape, but also the rural landscape that it puts onto the city as a way of imagining the spatial organisation of borough law. So archives then can represent a kind of textual mapping, in that what we find within the urban archive is the attempt to preserve generation after generation custom laws, charters, accounts of perambulations, written descriptions of the urban landscape within which borough law operates. Fourthly then, if archives can be about power, I think they can also be about resistance. Recent work in subaltern studies points to the ways in which domination and resistance are intertwined with one another. I want to briefly depart from urban custom onto rural custom. In 16th and 17th century England, there's an intense struggle in the countryside over tenurial rights, in particular tenurial form known as copyhold, which is a form of tenure upon the land, which is defined by local custom, whereas freehold is uniform across England and Wales, from one parish to another, from one county to another. The form of freehold doesn't vary. Copyhold varies from one manor to another. And copyhold emerges in the late medieval period in the course of a decomposition of feudalism. And what does the term mean? Well, increasingly over the course of the later 14th, 15th, early 16th centuries, tenants come to their lords and ask for, well, in some cases demand, quite forcibly demand, copies of their tenure, written accounts of the rights which they have upon the land and the boundaries of the land which they hold, individual field holdings. And they want this because it's within the possession of the text of a lease upon the land. They can legitimate the claims they're making to the land. And the phrase copyhold literally refers to the copy of a document by which they can justify the holding. By the early 16th century, within rural communities, therefore, often quite humble people are collecting into their hands leases, perambulations, legal documentation, which validate their claims upon the land. Archives, then, aren't solely institutional. Archives can be based upon family, can be based upon the household. By the early 16th century, including amongst people who aren't able to read or write, you see the development of a textual consciousness amongst English rural labouring classes, whereby they collect into their hands documentation which sustains their claims to rights upon the land, either within individual households or collectively within manors and parishes. So archives then, yeah, can be about power. They can be about institutional power in the formal sense of politics. They can be about that fuzzier sense of Foucauldian power. But they can also be about resistance, because it's on the basis of the possession of those written documents that ordinary people within the countryside, and also, as we will see, within the town and the city, are able to contest the claims that their rulers are making upon them. It's through the use of the documents produced out of customary law, such as, for example, the institution of copyhold, that ordinary people, poorer and middling people, are able to sustain claims in the present. And for that reason, they create their own little archives, all of their own, locked away in a little chest sitting under a bed or maintained within a parish church, by which they justify the claims which they're making upon the land. And this is one such collection of documents. This is the Weardale chest from the Northern Pennines. The chest is mid-17th century, and it was held within a major yeoman. It passed from hands from one major yeoman family to another within the Weardale area. And what the Weardale chest comprised was a large collection of legal documentation relating to the Weardale area, stretching back to the 14th century and up into the 1650s, to the time at which it was collected into the hands of the tenants of Weardale. And it's collectively owned by the tenants of the Weardale area. And the documentation relates to prior claims upon the land, to legal disputes, surveys, estate correspondence, all the stuff that individual tenants had relating to customary claims within Weardale, customary claims which by the 1650s were being undermined, are coming into... I'll shut up quickly. we're collecting up all of this documentation in an attempt to create a kind of an institutional basis to the documentary claim, a documentary basis to the institutional claims upon the land which we're making. Now, I was going to zip on to talk about the urban archive, but very, very quickly, linking this map of Norwich in 1589 to the urban archive, this is a map which is produced in the late 16th century in the course of legal claims on the part of poorer inhabitants of the city of Norwich to pasture rights and fuel rights on an extensive area of common land in the top and right-hand side of the map, an area called Mousehold Heath. And written into the map are a series of statements about the history of the land. At the top part of the map, there's a statement about the discovery of the body of St. William of Norwich, a little boy who was found murdered in the 13th century, and who, the murder of which was blamed on the Jews of Norwich, and which led to England's first pogrom. That legend is written into the top part of the map. The central part of the map describes the area known as Lollard's Pit, which is where Thomas Bilney, the early reformer and a series of Marian martyrs, were burnt in the 16th century and prior to that Lollards. Early sort of proto-Protestants, I suppose, early religious radicals were burnt in the 15th century. And alongside that, we have a depiction of something called the Oak of Reformation, which is the oak under which Norfolk rebels rallied in 1549 in an attempt to reverse, in a rebellion, attempting to reverse the economic and social changes which they were witnessing. So what you have within the Mansfield map then, it's a kind of memory site. It's textual in that it represents a written statement of the boundaries and the history of the Mousehold Heath area, but it's also visual in the sense that it's a cartographic expression of that landscape. Critically, that is produced at the same time as written documentation concerning the bounds and entitlements upon Mousehold Heath. Written accounts of the bounds which find their way into not only the urban archive but also into the hands of poorer people. So to conclude then, what I'm trying to suggest is that if we're to understand the urban archive, we need to understand it not only as a collection of documentation which sustains institutional and elite claims to rights and entitlements and power, but we also need to understand it as a vernacular archive which can be used by poorer people to contest authority in the present.
Thank you very much indeed, Andy. Opening our horizons and widening, as you say, stretching the concept of the archive further. So, finally, in this session, Judith Pohlmann, chronicling the local.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for having me here. This picture of a wolf eating a child comes from the Chronicle of Jean Burel, made in Le Puy-en-Velay. One of the many local chronicles that I've been thinking about recently. From the Middle Ages until well into the 19th century, a remarkable number of middle and upper class men in Europe took it upon themselves to chronicle current events in their own communities. Such texts were rarely printed in the lifetimes of their authors, but they circulated in the localities and were frequently read and continued by authors in successive generations. Some cities and regions had a particularly strong chronicling tradition, like Puy, for instance, or a city like Nuremberg in Germany, Bristol in England, or Ghent in Flanders. Now, although hundreds and perhaps even thousands of such chronicles have survived, scholars have so far devoted very little systematic attention to the post-medieval afterlife of the genre of the chronicle, this type of non-institutional local record-keeping. Medieval chronicles have been, of course, very well studied as one of the main genres of medieval historical writing. But students of early modern historiography have been rather dismissive of chronicles as a distinctly old-fashioned and uninteresting type of text. Because very few of them were published in print, they've also been quite easy to ignore for the historians of ideas who have studied historical thought, early modern historical thought. On the other hand, students of the early modern self and early modern emotions have often looked at chronicles but been very disappointed by them. Their authors often tell us only very few things about themselves, although there is often to be gleaned a bit more than you think at first sight. But what there is often a very, seems very erratic collection of information about people, the individual authors. So falling between the stools of history and autobiography, chronicles of this type have mainly been used as a source for local history. A handful of German scholars especially have been thinking hard about the genre, but they too have been doing so in a local or regional context. What no one has therefore, I think, tried to do is to explain the remarkable popularity, ubiquity and persistence of this genre of text among literate European males. The scholar who has come closest to doing so has been James Amelang, whose Flight of Icarus in 1998 analysed many chronicles that had been written by artisans. But focusing as he did on the artisan experience, he did not really ask why local chronicles written by artisans bear such a resemblance to those written by farmers and lawyers and merchants and pastors and school teachers. Now, in this paper, I want to develop some preliminary ideas on two questions. First of all, how we may account for that popularity and the cross-European appeal of this type of text. And secondly, what we might stand to gain from studying the practicing of chronicling comparatively over time and space and in a rather different way than it has been looked at before. Now, my thinking about these issues has been stimulated by the questions relating to urban memory that have been raised by a group of colleagues in Belgium, two of them are here, in a project called City and Society in the Low Countries that's financed by the Belgian state. The ideas that I present here also owe much to Brecht de Zeuren, who's been working with me as a postdoc in Leiden, and to a group of our graduate students who've been producing some very inspiring case studies last semester of different chronicles. Now, our predecessors have devoted a great deal of energy in distinguishing between annals and chronicles, commentaries, histories, yearbooks, and so on. But medievalists today have concluded that this is not really very useful, and I think they are right. In this paper, I will be using a very basic definition of what I'm interested in, an act of literacy by someone who decides that he is well suited to keep a record of events in his community, who believes that these events are worth recording, and that the best way to structure that information is to do so chronologically. Sometimes authors do that retrospectively, so they might start before their own lifetime. Some even still continue to start with Adam and Eve, as medieval chroniclers have done. But the people I'm mostly interested in here are those who also or mainly try to record the events of their own lifetime. Now, this sort of chronicling is very much a manuscript affair. People clearly knew how to do it, but not because they had read books by other people who knew how to do it, at least not printed books. The genre spread and survived because chronicles were borrowed, copied, passed on, and so on, and you can see that chronicles must have functioned in a network. Here and there, we have evidence that local people knew of one another, who wrote about current affairs, and that they used very many different ways of talking about that. You can see that, for instance, in the chronicle of Cornelis Veen in the village of Oostzaandam in Holland, who explained his decision to write a chronicle as follows. The harsh winter of the year 1740 gave occasion to these notes, because at that time many people were found who were keeping a journal. But most of them left the matter when the winter was over and stopped the work they had started. I, who did not choose to write a diary, just recorded a few things following my own fancy. And since the Emperor Charles VI also died this year, I foresaw great devastation on earth. And yet I could never have imagined that this would have such a great influence on us. These things made me decide to proceed with describing everything as a chronicle, and to furthermore add exceptional things that took place in our community. So you can see the many terms that he uses to describe things that we all might find a type of chronicling. Now, I think that local chronicles of this type were first written by lay people in medieval Italy, but that genre seems to have moved up north in the 15th century, and by the 16th century, chronicles are being written all over Europe. In medieval Italy, what I've read about this tells me that chronicles were used especially to record urban pride in the military achievements of the author's commune. Among later chroniclers, too, there's a strong identification not just with military achievements, but with the urban fabric, sites of memory, and local devotions. In some places, lay chroniclers seem to have built on the official practice of keeping a chronicle of local events that Andy was also referring to. Members of urban elites began to order copies of those texts and eventually also to customize them to their own liking, to include things that they thought interesting. That tradition, I think, is at the basis of what other people started to do. That explains why the focus of these texts is so local, and why things like the annual appointment of local officials, for instance, is often a feature of them, even in the chronicles of those people who are not in striking distance of ever becoming a local official themselves. I think that the desire to customize these texts also explains why they were never printed. It's interesting, there are certainly German chronicles of which there are dozens of versions and copies around, but apparently this never gave local printers the idea that you might actually successfully market these things. What was interesting about them, what people liked about them, was actually doing their own thing with an existing text, if they used an existing text at all. Now, the motives that people gave for writing differed, of course, enormously, but at the same time less so than you might imagine. One distinctive category of texts emerged out of political crises, war, and civil conflicts. Many authors took up their pens to record what shocking events were upsetting their lives and to teach their readers the lessons that there were to be learned from them. M. Fouy, Jean Burel, the man who drew The Child and the Wolf, thought he should keep a chronicle so that the young would learn to recognize the wrath of God, as he had done in the string of great wars, famine, plague, and discourse that he had witnessed in late 16th century Fouy. That there were things for which God was to be praised was now also to be known, but mainly because it had been recorded to memory by me, Jean Burel. So God was doing a good thing, but nobody would know about it until Jean Burel stepped in. For the Catholic tailor Willem Weitz in Bruges, the quartering of Spanish troops in 1568 marked the beginning of evil times and thus also of his chronicle, which got at times got worse as Bruges briefly became a Calvinist republic. But in 1584, Weitz thought he could complete work on his chronicle, and I quote, "because of the changing of the times and because we have the church back, thanks be to God who has granted us mercy." His job, he thought, was now over. He referred his readers who wanted to know more to a printed almanac, which also had a chronicle in it. I think a short list of dates would have been in that instance. Now, the desire to modernists have seen the recording of rupture and crisis in the late 18th century as something that is unique to that period. But actually, I think that if we look at late 18th century chronicles, they seem to be prompted by quite similar sorts of things, recording shocking changes, great rupture, things that are upsetting the lives of the chroniclers. While some authors were often unashamedly partisan and keen to give their views of conflicts, some also seem to have used their chronicles simply to try and retain or create some sort of grip on the complexities of the situations in which they were finding themselves. Zandam author Cornelis Veen, who we already met, in 1748 wrote up his account of the War of the Austrian Succession. The narrative did not really establish a precise hierarchy between the different things that the villagers experienced during that time. Close to home, they had witnessed a comet, cold weather, high prices, an infestation with mice, cattle disease, and an embarrassing episode in which a flying ship had been launched only to sink immediately in the local harbour. Veen presented these local events side by side, first with the death of European kings, declarations of war across the borders, then with the Netherlandish drama of a French invasion, and the elevation of the young Prince of Orange to the stadtholderate in 1747. It was only at that stage that war actually came to his village. Nevertheless, at least retrospectively, Veen thought it was appropriate to collect all of these events in the village together in one narrative, only loosely connecting them with the idea that this had all somehow been an expression of God's wrath. By chronicling disorder and discontinuity, war chroniclers like Veen, of course, showed their commitment to the concern of most other authors of chroniclers, a commitment to try and record order and continuity. In 1503, Honoré de Valbel, a citizen from Marseille,
expressed that desire as such. I have often thought, Valbel, that if our ancestors had not left us written accounts of the events of their times, we would be like people without order. And so that the order will always continue, and because the inhabitant of one area cannot know everything, everyone in his place should do this in such a way that everything that has been noted will be fully known. So we all have a local responsibility to do our bit for collective knowledge of the past. Now, order in local chronicles is established very much by the recording of urban cycles, like the appointment of officials, annual processions, feasts. Look at the people, authors in the 16th century, Netherlands certainly used processions and the display at them as an indication of how the state of how the city is faring. If there are lots of candles, things are better than if there are few candles, that sort of thing. But order is, of course, also affirmed by the very things that disturb it, like the accidents and violent crimes and executions that seem to have been a source of endless fascination for early modern chroniclers. Some chroniclers end up being catalogues of violent death. Lessons of a moral, religious, and supernatural kind could be found in the extraordinary, the special, and the freakish. They are rich in references to prodigies, signs in the skies, and so on. Although you would have expected that to decline, perhaps, over time, our impression so far is that the 18th century records are just as full of those as the records from the 16th century. Authors did not necessarily say why they thought these things were significant, but they clearly thought that they had to be recorded and remembered. That points to another significant and perhaps less obvious characteristic of early modern chronicles, which is in the quest for patterns. The enormous interest in recording details of the weather, of causes of death, and price developments is to be explained by that interest. It seems to have existed right across the period. A 15th century Italian chronicler already noted that he recorded the weather so as to establish a regola, a rule. Jan de Potthoff from Brussels in the 16th century preceded his journal with a range of maxims about the correlation between dates and weather conditions and other events. His contemporary Jean Perrin from Orange used his chronicle to test popular wisdom about the weather against the evidence as it was unfolding year by year. But there were also other correlations to be thought about. Miguel Perret, tanner in Barcelona, began a chronicle in 1651 so as to record what there was to be learned from a plague epidemic. And an 18th century chronicler in the Dutch village of Huizen used his account mainly to chronicle a period of cattle disease, believing that he had established a link between the death of local cattle and the time at which farmers had mucked out their stables. So he was recording all the deaths from day to day with the mucking out time recorded. Now, although chroniclers often said that they were interested in the memorable, they were thus not only intending to create a historical record. They were collecting their own archive of information that could be useful also in structuring the present and in predicting the future. Now, considering that much historical thinking, of course, was focused on analogies, it should not surprise us that they did so in what we think of as a historical genre. But it means that we have tended to read the texts too much as historical texts that try to be historical. I think to understand them, we may need to change what Adam yesterday called to change our interpretive protocol. We need to think about them more as collections of information, as tools for the reception, story, and creation of knowledge. Now, if we do that, you can see that more of what the authors were trying to do becomes understandable. It's interesting that many of the authors stressed that they a sort of civic responsibility. We have seen examples of this in Valbel and in Burel, but they seem to actually almost all literate, all chroniclers serve to confirm these literate men in their local sense of local importance, because they are becoming the arbiters of what is and what is not useful, memorable, and perhaps even true knowledge. Now, Now, in some instances, the author really had access to knowledge that other people didn't have, perhaps because they knew something about art. They had access to archives sometimes. Sometimes they had access to, they claimed to have been first-hand witnesses sometimes, but many of them also used texts. And one of the things that I find most interesting and remarkable about the chronicling tradition is that they offer us such a very interesting evidence on the way in which people engage with oral, written, and printed media. Many authors did not try to keep away from that, but engaged constantly with other sources of information. They copied ordinances, pamphlets, poets, and songs, and made references to printed histories. And you might expect chronicles to have been superseded by the ever-growing stream of pamphlets, newspapers, magazines, and annual yearbooks as they unfolded over the course of the centuries. But initially, at least, the appearance of more books and more new media did not lessen the interest in keeping a chronicle. Quite the opposite. The new media raised the expectations of what knowledge you could include and should include in a chronicle. So Cornelis Veen explains that he didn't need to describe the festivities for the elevation of William IV in the larger cities, because there were already entire books about those. What he needed to do was to describe the festivities in his native village of Zaandam. Had those entire books about festivities in the big towns not existed, it is unlikely that Veen would have thought he needed to record exactly how the fireworks had been produced. Chronicler Jan Clout from the small Holland town of Brille explained that he decided to start his chronicle when he discovered that the yearbook, the news yearbook for 1747, failed to mention anything about events in his town. He began to record local news for himself and was to keep up the habit until the 1790s. By the 18th century, some chronicles increasingly became a sort of running commentary on newspaper clippings. So people were copying or clipping bits out of newspaper and writing things around or with them. Clearly, newspapers fulfilled all sorts of useful functions, but they did not supersede the chronicle. Quite the opposite, they encouraged people to improve on the newspapers. So I think a second way in which we can change our protocol is not just to think about these texts as collections of knowledge, but also to think of them beyond the scope of the local. Chronicling is not just an expression of localism, a separate sphere from the world of print media and super-local events. Instead, I think chronicles enable us to gauge the extent to which people integrated the local, the national, and the transnational in their representation of what was important to their community, and in turn try to show how their community might matter regionally, nationally, or even internationally. So I've scratched the surface of the early modern chronicle in the last few months, and I think that that has led me to believe that the genre is probably coherent and stable enough for it to be studied comparatively over time and across the European space. That, I think, that is important because the stability of the genre offers us something that we don't really have, something about not about the supply side of novelty, not about new books, new politics, and so on, but actually a way of gauging reception over a quite large sample of texts written by literate and pretty ordinary men. They're almost always men. Similarly, we might find out by looking at these texts more systematically whether ideas lost sway and how long that took. Now, the hurdles to actually doing that are formidable, and I hope that some of you, not necessarily in this discussion, but later on, may have some ideas on how we might do that. But I think, clearly, we need to know much more about the scale, the spread, the persistence, the social profile, possible changes in that. What I would like to put to you here is that it might be interesting to try and do that. Either I couldn't do it just by myself, so we would have to do it together, not all with you in person, but perhaps I'd like to see whether you like the idea of doing that. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much all for a fantastic session.
directions. So we now open up for questions.
Thank you. I think this was a really interesting panel all across all three. I mean, my question for whoever wants to take it, but Judith, I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say. In terms of chronicles, this is somewhere where on the Arabic side we have a good deal of local chronicle writing, some of which by, you know, there's a famous one by the Barber of Damascus. There's all sorts of, you know, people, social composition, writing these texts. One of the things that often comes through is a sort of praising of the virtues of the local city, in some cases, but some sort of celebratory aspect for local. Does that happen in these sorts of local chronicles that you've looked at?
Yes, I think it does very much so, and especially when people are describing important moments and so on. It's also a way of being critical of people who are not maintaining the local traditions as they ought to, and so on. So it's a two-way thing. I think one of the things about local chronicling is that these people take responsibility by sort of saying, I am responsible for representing the history of this city. They're also making themselves important through the city, as it were. So the city, the community, is vital to what these people are doing, and perhaps I should stress that even more. But it's not just, at the same time, that the community is also a vehicle for them to show how important they are, as it were. So, does that help? Yeah.
Okay. Next question is Filippo.
Yeah. Two questions. One for Andy, one for Judith. Fantastic panel. For Andy, do you get a sense of how differently the documents were ordered, catalogued, if they were catalogued, or just literally arranged in that chest and in the chests of the gentry, you know, the two different archives you talked about. And for you, so this is a million-dollar question for a one-minute answer, but do you get a sense of change over time? I mean, you've been talking about chronicles in the 15th and the 18th century.
Yeah, unfortunately, the contents of Weird Ale chest were taken out of a chest in the late 19th century and calendars by Durham University's Library Special Collections. So they're all now in neat little boxes. So they've all been recalendered by professional archivists. But No. Sadly not. But yeah, that's right. The chest was collected up in the early 1650s in the course of a dispute over a customary right called tenant right, by which the tenants of Weird Ale claimed that they had wide common rights, but also fixed rents, which was being challenged by a Durham gentleman called Sir Arthur Hazelrigg. But it was also, the tenant right dispute stretched back way back into the mid-16th century. And so what the tenants did was collected all the evidence they had, going way back to the 14th century concerning Weird Ale. But what's beautiful about the material is that that there are notes on the documents showing the ways in which the material is subsequently used in later legal cases. So you can't show how it's organised, but you can show the way in which it's deployed in later legal cases.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, I think there are changes. So there is this. I'm trying to. I think this. I've been emphasizing the stability of the genres in many ways, but I think that is what enables us to study change. So precisely because it will enable you to chart whether people are using other sources of information, whether they are relating more frequently or less frequently to what the king is doing, whether they are thinking more in terms of scientific explanations for their weather phenomena in the 18th century than they did before, whether their ambitions with this text become less focused on the moral and more on the natural, all sorts of questions that you could ask about this, I think, if you, and perhaps also chart by looking at it over a longer period of time.
my question, thanks for a very interesting panel. My question for all speakers is related to religion, the role of religion in what you're talking about. For the first and the third papers, these type of sources are often exemplary. Is that related to modes that you see in religious discourse, or is there any parallel there? And for Andy, I was fascinated by the discussion of custom and limitation of custom to area. The clergy withdrawing from certain roles, does this influence this use of custom? Because in Japan it does, the Buddhist monasteries are sort of suppressed and withdraw from drawing the lines, and then you see a similar sort of process to what you're talking about, but it's related to the position of the clergy. I don't know if it's...
You're asking about where is Fudge as a literary mode, and I think it is. I mean, harking back to Adam Smith's paper yesterday, we can wonder where we can read archives of literary texts, and I think this is a prime example of that. But it moves, I think it only works within a very specific social setting. And as soon as, for example, this Betty Noble was confronted with other players, let's say peasantry, his attitudes toward the archives would be very different, and his gaze of the archive would function differently, I think. So, but within a given target audience, within a certain logic of storytelling, he used the archives indeed in a literary mode. Does that answer your question, or?
The interaction between religious modes.
Well, sorry, did catch a bit. It is there, but very subliminally, and it's the sense that he's presenting himself as a good lord, and the ideal of good lordship is, of course, fueled by Christian traditions, and it's there, but it's not a major strand in his narrative. So.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things you see in it is that, in a way, the religious modes of thinking go so well side by side with all sorts of other modes of thinking, so that, in a way, the moral lesson you might draw from a comet the coincidence of a comet and war or something like that might be coupled with a much more concrete idea on if it rains in February, the prices will go up in June, if you see what I mean. So it more shows up that I think that it puts religion in its place in some ways, in that it shows, it is very important in as a frame of giving meaning to and suggesting meaning and possible meaning, but there are all sorts of other possible ways of establishing correlations between different sorts of events, because I think that is the patterning that people are doing is partly about that. So.
Yep. Well, as regards to this question about local clergy, one of the big disputes that comes up repeatedly before central courts and church courts is the question of tithe. Whether or not ministers are able to claim a one-tenth tithe over agricultural or industrial produce, and that varies from one parish to another. So very often the minister finds himself at odds to parishioners' claims to local custom, as regards parochial custom. And the result of that is that parish parochial documentation becomes a kind of contested site within the parish. As different groups are struggling to define what local parochial custom is. And that's apparent even within the form of the preservation of the documentation, which initially, before all of this stuff had shifted into record offices in the 1950s and 1960s, all of this documentation is maintained within parish chests, very like the Weardale chest, which are often held in the most sacred parts of the church, or alternatively in former chantry chapels. And that's where the records of parochial administration, but also, if you like, of sort of local memory, are maintained and preserved. And within that, you'll find parish registers, surveys, lists of inhabitants, records relating to the payment of tithe. And classically, the locks for those chests will be three or four or five locks on them, and those will be distributed between the minister, the church warden, the bailiff, what we call the substantial men of the parish, so that no one interest group can access the documentation. So even the access to the documentation is kind of negotiated.
Okay,
Thank you. Margaret Proctor, University of Liverpool. This is for Andy. I enjoyed your paper very much. Just a couple of comments. Firstly, the idea of copyholders keeping their copies of their documents in order to establish their own rights, I think, has a much longer history than you suggest, and certainly evidence for that in the later Middle Ages, even in a pre-literate context as well, when the object became as evidence as the fact that it was either readable or not. But secondly, I really enjoyed your reference to archives as sites of empowerment and sites as power. And I think that joins us up with current day archival thinking, of which we haven't perhaps heard as much as we ought to have done in this kind of context, perhaps something for last night. And the way in which the historian's use of archives over the last 200 years is really an aberration from the main purpose of archival, the maintenance of archival forms. Historically, archives has been all about privileges and upholding justice. Modern archival thinking, certainly from the 1970s, 1980s onwards, sees archives not as historical resources, but as sites of social justice. And I think this is where the academic archivists in this room differ very much from the historians in this room, with whom we seem to be outnumbered on this occasion, as seeing archives as very living entities, as very promoting social justice in particular, and this develops out of the human rights agenda of the post-war era, obviously, or the fall of repressive movement, which is slightly off kilter with the rest of the conference, but I think what I want to say, or what I want to indicate, is that the thematic, if you're looking at archives over time, the theme is justice and rights, and historically, it has been the rights of the institutions and the creators. It's now rights as we understand it in a human rights context. And as I say, the historian's use of archives is sort of a mere aberration on the face of, 5,000 years worth of record keeping, really. Thank you.
I think that might actually be a very good point on which to spot. Let's have the last word. I know that there are a large number of other questions that people would have liked to have asked, but I think we must move on. So I hope that you'll have the opportunity to catch up with people during the break. Can I ask you to be back here at 11 o'clock sharp? Thank you very much.